The following message is by Pastor John Piper. More information from Desiring God is available at www.desiringgod.org.
It depends on how long it takes her to heal after what kind of episiotomy she had and this kind of stuff. But it's very different with other girls, too. I had a girl in my office the other day that the doctor had said from the 7th month on, she'd been pregnant 3 months, and he said, don't do it anymore. They can stimulate each other various ways. So you don't have to masturbate in that situation. But what I'm saying is, what one pastor said was, well, it's not the best. In other words, all those guys know the power we're dealing with here. And that in the long run, there come times when it's just impossible to keep that force from releasing itself. Just impossible. And that's why I said it would probably be the lesser evil, and whether it has to be an evil, I don't even know in those situations. I think that if we could just control it, guys, now I'm talking about, control it so that it isn't habitual, so that that our imaginations are not every second day, pouring up before us some scene that is requiring orgasm to let off the steam. If we could avoid that, then we wouldn't need to worry too much about these periodic, now and then, explosions that have to be let off. I hope I'm not saying something too loose there. But
well, what you're saying that we have to, then it's considered a have to sin? Do we have a choice to abstain?
Yeah, I can't talk about a have to sin because Paul said that there's no temptation.
There's no temptation. Okay, so right. What if we want to stop completely?
You can't
forever.
You can't.
So how do we do that?
All right, let's see. Next question: how shall a single person handle his sexual or her sexual desires? I got 6 things written down. What do you do with them? That follows naturally on. If you don't want to masturbate and you don't want to do that and you shouldn't, then what do? Number one, recognize your sexual desires as natural and good and only to be satisfied according to God's word. Don't condemn yourselves for having the desire. That's one of the main things we should get across. God made us this way, and what we're trying to figure out is why he did and how he wants us to handle them. Second, avoid stimulating them. Now, in our day, that are out. Some TV, maybe most, I don't have a TV, so I don't know, is out. Now, when I say they're out, like most magazines are out, say Time Magazine. What do you do with Time Magazine? Time Magazine, all the news magazines plan to have a sexy picture at a certain place. They all plan it. They know exactly what they're doing. You can turn to the movie section, the theater section, or the drama section. And that's where you find them, usually. And then the advertising, of course. They all know that they need a little bit of porno in there so they can sell more to the teenagers prudish guys who won't buy Playboy. So what do you do with Time Magazine and other good magazines that you need to keep up on in the news? Well, I think once you learn the tactics of the magazine, you can handle that probably. You can simply skip it. If you see it, you turn the page. Now that is hard, because for a Christian who won't go into the drugstore and buy one of the 5 big porno magazines, he usually is looking for pictures in other places. His body is looking for them. And therefore, he has to will in his head, I will not stop to meditate on that picture and let it stimulate me. And I think the same would probably hold true with the girls with certain kinds of pictures of guys. So, while you can't probably totally avoid TV and you can't totally avoid magazines and they're none of these things, movies would I say totally avoid, know them well enough and know yourself well enough how to avoid the pauses and the ponderings on them. Here's an example. Is it going to come out? Yeah. This is my third point. When stimulation comes, consciously take that desire and transfer it to Christ and make Him your desire. I only learned to do that after I got married. I got that from 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 2, where it says, desire the sincere spiritual milk of the Word that you may live thereby. It's a command to desire Christ. Here's an example of the way I do it. Riding down 280 from by Luther Seminary there, Como Avenue, and there up to the right is Touch Black Velvet. Now, she's totally clothed. That's one of the sexiest pictures in the city, right? She's sitting there with her leg up like this, and I say, Touch Black Velvet. Well, what? You know! What they're saying to do? Take your hand and rub it right down her leg. That's what they want you to do with your mind. Touch Black Velvet. It's a liquor advertisement. You've all seen those, I think. And it's a girl with this black pantsuit on from here to the bottom of her toe. And it's the sexiest advertising picture on the Negley signs. What do I do now? See, I'm riding down there, I see that. And somebody is asking me to touch that girl. Well, the desire comes to touch that girl. And so I say to myself, I ain't going to touch that girl. Jesus, the desire that I feel, this little desire, I don't have much anymore. I've done this so often, it's almost second nature because those signs are everywhere. Jesus, the desire I feel right now, I give to you. I want you more than I want that. And what I'm feeling welling up in me now, I direct to you. And then I just pray. I talk to Jesus. I have a little conversation. She's gone now. And it has never failed to work that he takes that thought away from me. At least with that sign. It has never failed to work. He saved me from that. And I can do that on more and more things now, where I consciously say no to a burgeoning desire and transfer it. You see, if you don't transfer it, you'll fail. An empty mind will be filled with sex. You gotta fill it with something else. It's like the demons. You take one demon away, if you leave that room empty, swept and clean, seven more sexy demons will come back. You gotta fill that room up with good things. Set your mind on things that are above. Good things. So I just talk about the Lord and I think about the cross especially. It's hard to have a sexy feeling when you think about a bleeding Savior on the cross. The cross has saved me from lots of sexual fantasies. So that's the third thing. Consciously direct your desire towards Christ.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When you're driving down 280 and say you're just feeling kind of blasé about life, should you intentionally look at that picture so you can get the desire to shift to Christ?
Never.
Come on.
Too risky for me. But that, I do that sort of thing with other things. I use poetry that way. I have sat down and read lines composed above Tinder and Abbey to get me ready for Sunday. It's not a religious poem, but it is so powerfully emotionally moving that it awakens me. But I can't. I am too sinful to use sex that way. Yeah. Yes. And nature is God's great gift to awaken our hearts, isn't it? If you're feeling blah, take a walk out on the lake at sunset or sunrise. That's God's gift to a blasé heart. Don't take the world's, or the Satan would just laugh his head off if I were to try that.
Ha ha, God, my brilliant.
Fourth, already said that. Pray for God to divert our attention. So the third one was consciously direct your stimulation, your desire towards Christ. Then fourth, pray that God will divert your attention. Fifth, get busy with some task. Leisure is a great sexual stimulator. Boy, I can look back on my teenage days and the the Saturdays and the Sundays when Mom and Dad were gone away for home, those were the bad days. When I could do whatever I pleased. I had all the leisure in the world and no hindrances, whatever, nothing to do. Then my imagination was uncontrollable. But when I had homework to do, good program to watch on TV, a basketball game to go to at night, something to keep my mind and my body busy, then it wasn't as great a problem. Watch out for overmuch loafing around and leisure and empty-headedness.
Well, how do you relax then? I mean, if there are, can you go to a basketball game and be relaxed?
Yeah, right.
Because you can't grind all the time.
No. But I think to grind hard enough so that when you fall into bed, you fall asleep is better than to be piddling around all day so that when you fall into bed, you can't fall asleep, and then what happens? Well, then your mind is just going and
is there a possible overindulgence
yourself over to Yes. If I were lecturing on something else, I'd probably make a big case for why you should take more leisure to take walks. And yes, we've got to have leisure or our spirits will dry up. If you're so busy that you never take a walk or just rest. But then, I've given part of the answer, haven't I? There's a way to sit around and do nothing, and there's a way to let God's good gifts fill our leisure. Take a walk in nature. I very seldom had a problem with sexual imaginations taking a walk in the woods, even though some people, I suppose, might associate the woods with a grotto and a fairy and, you know, just nifty scenes. But for me, nature and sunshine and clouds and trees and pine needles, they're not sexy to me. They're so uplifting and purifying and they make me think of the Narnia books and C.S. Lewis and further up and further in and heaven and God and relationships. So if they're that way for you, then you can use those for your leisure.
Does C.S. Lewis write on any books on that topic?
Sex? The Four Loves has a whole chapter on Venus, which is really good.
Four Loves?
Yeah, he's got a book called The Four Loves. You all should read The Four Loves. Terrific. One of them is sex, eros. Storge, eros, philos, and agape are the four Greek words for love that he talks about. And eros is sex. That's where you'll find what Lewis has to say about sex. Last six, resolve to be pure, 100% God's. And read great literature of devotion and biography. Find the things that stimulate your devotion to God. I was just telling Noel last night as I was running my radio up and down on the way up here on those 60 miles on 35, trying to find something to listen to, keep me awake. And I hit one song, I played one old song from 1968 that I remember. What was that? And I listened to it. It was kind of nostalgic. That's when we were going together. And then I turned it off and I said, you know, I really changed in the way that I make decisions about what to fill my mind with. When I was a teenager, I used to struggle to ask, what's wrong with rock music and that sort of thing? What's wrong with it? Why shouldn't I listen to it? I don't even ask that question to myself anymore. I ask the question, will it make me love God more? That's the only question I care about. Does it make me get aflame with the Holy Spirit? Does it make my devotion go deeper and my affections rise higher? And the question of right and wrong to me, that is rules and it's wrong for this and this and this reason, I don't even get to that. I usually knock it off earlier because most of the music on the radio worldlyizes me. Word secularizes me, deadens me to the highest and most beautiful things, and I don't want that. So my sixth thing is try to become the kind of person who wants to be God's 100%. Then lots of the questions of is this exact thing right or is that exact thing right and wrong won't be nearly as important as will doing that draw me nearer to the heart of God. That's the only thing you'll care about. Care about. I had two more questions. how attractive should we want to be, or how should we want to be attractive, and then homosexuality. We'll just take these real briefly so you can have a break. Here's what I think about dress and attractiveness. Girls and guys should not dress so as to stimulate sexual desire. When that happens at a distance, it only creates problems. And that means you're going to have to really buck the system, because I think the style that the world prescribes is designed for sexual attraction. Girls and guys should not dress so as to stimulate sexual desire.
So, I have a question that relates to that. I was at Newport earlier this year and a bunch of stuff on people wanting to follow the fashions. And the fashions, of course, are geared toward the world. And so there's all kinds of stimulating innuendo about different parts of the dress and stuff like that. So that's not right.
Good.
But it just seems that, you know, at Bethlehem Christian School, the attitudes of a lot of people are to...
Lots of girls are insensitive to this. Now, maybe lots of guys are too, and I don't know it because they don't turn me on in the least. But lots of girls are. And I went to Bear Trap Ranch. When was that? Summer of 68? No, 78. And they divided the guys and the girls up. These were college students from secular campuses. They divided them up and set the girls on this side facing the guys and the guys on this side facing the girls, and they said, now, tell each other what bugs you sexually about each other. This was really interesting. And one of those guys stood up and said, I cannot take it. The shorts you girls are wearing here this summer. Now, that was back in the short period when around Bethel. Not only the track shorts, not only were they short, but then the split up the side. I just cannot believe that Christian girls around Bethel would do that to the guys. Don't you know?
That was you or not.
Don't they know what they're doing? Good night. A bikini is not as sexy as a pair of loose shorts. I don't know if you girls know this, but exposure is not as sexy as almost exposure. You know that now, if you didn't know it before. Exposure is not as sexy as almost exposure, which is why I cannot understand what's going on with the buttons in our day. Why the second button is unbuttoned? What's the reason for that? On girls' blouses, and I suppose guys' shirts too. What? I can think of no reason. To me, I want to walk up to every girl and button their... And now I've learned, they mean it to be that way. I don't know what's going on. Well, I do know what's going on. Mademoiselle, the Journal, 17, have them dressed that way. That's all, right? I mean, where else? Nobody just up and decided, I'll leave my second button unbuttoned this morning, so it kind of hangs open a little bit. So if you're standing right here, you can see right in. Those are the kinds of things Christian girls ought to think about, so they don't make it hard for the guys. Do you want a guy to be thinking about what color your bra is? Or do you want him to look at your face, see your eyes, think about you as a person? I mean, girls are up in arms today that they've been made sex objects, but half of them have their blouses unbuttoned. So, you better realize that even...
If I asked you to button your button, how would you react? Someone tell me.
No, I want to hear it. I want to hear some serious answers.
How would you react to that?
Because I know you. I called out. That wasn't something. Just because I know that you're direct and that you could say you wouldn't mind saying that to me, I'd go, fine, I probably wouldn't think a lot about it. I'd respect you, maybe, because most guys wouldn't say that.
Yeah. If someone did say that, it's true, though. If someone came up to me and said, say, baby, unbutton your second button, I'd say, go and jump in the lake. Or I'd slap him. I'm just saying, if someone came up to me and said, say, baby, unbutton your bra.
Button it up.
Oh, button it up?
Your point is even better. Everybody's doing it free, and you'd knock your block off if they asked you to do it.
There's one. I got lots of others I could talk about, but I won't. You got the idea. One of the principles of dressing is don't dress so as to create sexual diversion from your person. Dress, here's my next one. Clothing should reflect our tastes in color and style and our convictions about neatness and cleanliness and thrift and as many other things as we can symbolize with our clothes. Make your clothing a statement about you. If lots of guys and girls thought that their clothing was an outward symbolical statement, they'd dress differently, probably.
What is that?
Yeah. They don't realize what they're saying. They're consciously making a statement, but it is making a statement. Very carelessly making a statement. So, there are some girls who dress... I have in my mind girls from my background and from Bethel, I remember, who didn't dress expensively or inordinately. They were just always so neat, and they were clean, and their colors were right, and things seemed to go together, and they were poised, and I thought about them as persons. I just liked them as persons. It said so much about them as persons. And there were others who they just couldn't seem to dress any other way but sleazy. And I wondered, do they really mean to? I don't think she means to say that about herself. Not really. Her mother just didn't teach her right, I guess. Somebody needs to teach her what she's saying. And guys, too.
Are tuxedos sexy?
Tuxedo.
I've heard, okay, like a really nice tux, okay, like for band,
uh-huh.
You know, and we have to wear tuxedos. And girls come up and to guys and say, hey, you really look sharp tonight. And what do they mean? Do they mean it looks sexy, or do they mean you look presentable in a formal way, or what, you know?
Well, let me stand back just a minute, and because since I have no idea about what problems guys are creating for girls, you say something about what you would want to say to a guy. What would you be saying if you were here telling guys how they could help girls by their dress or not cause problems for girls?
I think guys have the same problems with athletics, but girls do. Yeah.
I don't even know what that is, but I
could fit it in a thimble.
I see. Okay. I didn't know. What else? I mean, those are pretty. There's no pool at Bethel yet. When there's a pool, there'll really be a problem.
Would guys walk around with their shirts unbuttoned? And I mean, I know it's different. It's different in a way, but sometimes. It depends on what kind of a woman you are and what it is that does excite you.
Yeah.
And it works the same way. Sometimes the hairless girl walks around in a stinky little dress because they're used to it. I'm sure that some girls, when they come into a room, if you were walking in a room, there were a bunch of guys standing with no shirts on, you go, oops, where am I? And you're used to it because you've seen it all your life. But depending on the way a guy wears his clothes and the kind of attitude he has about himself as he wears those clothes, Does he walk around with an attitude that looks like I'm wearing his clothes and showing off to himself?
Yeah.
With a different kind of body build, of course it's going to make a difference.
Sure.
But I guess it's just modesty and clothing makes such a whole difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's been, I don't know if other guys have had the same thing, but a few people have said, well, I carry myself well, and I look like I'm confident, stuff like that. Now, Jennifer, does that appear, or anyone who knows me, does that appear wrong? Am I carrying myself, like, am I flirting myself physically?
Too macho.
Too much. Too macho?
Too macho. That's the word.
I'm asking.
I don't know.
I'm putting that word in your mouth for the question. You don't come across to me that way. I mean.
Someone said I was innocent in a class.
You know, innocent, that's a good
one.
I like to look innocent.
Well, anyway, can someone answer?
I think it's kind of fun to watch what I hear.
I'm getting hot and bothered. I'm
going to
take off.
Your second button is unbuttoned. Becky, do you want to explain yourself?
Different when a guy looking at a girl dressed sexy, and when I look at a guy that looks in, I don't start thinking. I
And that can be true with girls too, I think. I mean, from guys to girls, if within certain parameters, their dress can signify all kinds of things that don't have to be sexual.
I think it's just very true. With body types, the female body is such a different thing. It means such a different thing to a man than the male body means to a woman. Because of society and the fact that female pornography for females is not something that many girls would run into in here, but I bet you most of the guys are running into pornography the other way. It's not something in society that's ever been accepted. Maybe people do it, but it's not something that they write statistics up about or anything. And because there isn't in that way, women have a different kind of a problem, you know, than just looking at a guy in the way he's dressed. Sure, a pair of really tight pants on a guy that looks like he's not wearing anything. Well, you know, that's going to be a visual startling thing to someone because it's not something that we've been used to as women. The tight pants that are going around these days are really new for me. And it does bother me. I mean, I feel almost embarrassed to do that. But it's, you know, that's about one of the only things that could possibly bother me because of the way men are built. No problem. We're used to that.
Right. It seems like it's more expensive in this manner of stimulation as making me uncomfortable.
Depending on the girl.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so out of it when it comes to talking about the way girls respond, but... Yet, most girls are not triggered. They don't have a hair trigger. A guy has a hair trigger so that a visual stimulation for him can make him ready for sex in an instant. Girls don't have hair triggers, but they can over time.
But those things that are visually, that catch your eye, keep you from talking to a guy the first time you see him, because your eye gets caught.
Yeah. Right. Now, I saw a hand over here. Anybody want? Okay.
Well, I'd just like to say, I've had a little training of hairdressing. There's a very fine line between beauty and sex, and to put a line, a lot of lines across that never happens. You know, in art, and, you know, the greatest art on people is nude.
Yeah.
And it's not just that.
Yeah, the word nude is not the same as the word naked to the artist. She's nude, she's not naked. I'm not a good artist in that regard. I remember reading, my name is Asher Lev. Remember that book? That was a sexy book for me. Now, it wouldn't have been at all for an artist. It would not have been a sexy book for an artist because... Was it a sexy book? Okay. All right. My name is Asher Lev, where this Jewish guy becomes an artist and... He has to paint this nude, and this nude girl walks in. That scene for me was very hard to take.
But, I think I have never been told of where I've been.
That's right. Sure.
A lot of
Yeah. Well, your transformation into a full artist happened after your high school experience. So that if you were to read that book now, it'd have a different impact on you than it did then. One other thing about clothing and dress. We should want to be known for how we act and are, not for how we appear on the outside. Dress so as not. That's going to make you laugh. I'll say it that way. Dress so such that your clothes are not seen. You see what I mean? Dress such that your clothes are not seen. I would just love it if the people's first impression when they saw me was my eyes. Probably because my eyes say more about me than anything. They'll show when I'm a little bit embarrassed, dart them away, you know, or they'll show when I'm happy because they'll get a little glisten, or they'll show when I'm sad because they're curled down on the end. But my clothes says nothing unless I've consciously made a statement. So I think it's just a good rule of thumb, dress so as your such that your clothes aren't seen. Now that'll mean you have to dress appropriately. If you've got a band, you've got to wear a tux. If you're going to a ball, you wear a long, nice dress. If you're going swimming, you wear a bathing suit, not a suit. You dress appropriately such that it fits the occasion and people don't bolt at it. Make a statement about your values with your clothes. That's all I have to say about clothing. Yes, Sam?
I'm afraid the overlooking that your clothing is bad. And I think it's good to get good so you look good. Be good about yourself in a way that you're not appreciated. And then this thing appropriated is something good. And there's nothing wrong with it.
Dressing appropriately. Well, that's what
so
I want.
Any having a nice suit on or a nice shirt or whatever, I think this is, I like this thing. I think that's good. I like
to say simple beauty. There is luxurious beauty and there is simple beauty. And I mean you may have different tastes than I do in that regard, but I loathe exorbitance in dress. I think you can dress simply and be very, the word attractive is funny. We usually use it when we don't mean it. Attractive means you attract attention. I know, so very appropriate. I like the word appropriate.
But the federal thing is
And then cross their legs. I'm sitting there at my desk and saying, good. And she wants me to talk seriously about this problem she has? And all I can see is her body. Not because of what she's wearing, because of what she's doing with it. Lying in that chair in front of me. Did it? Yes, I think you're right. I think you're right. I have been very tempted, Noel will tell you, at stages in my life to say I only want one color of pants, one kind of coat, only black socks, and only one color shirt, so that nobody knows when I change. When one goes to the laundry and one doesn't. And I think I kind of got hung up on that at certain points, and I think we can. So that clothes become such a thing that in order to not attract any attention, you make such a thing out of the clothes that they are the attention grabber. I think we can strike a balance. I'll tell you where I am halfway. I still have most of the clothes from way back, and I haven't bought any pants or sport coat in a long time. This velour shirt I have had from high school, if you can believe that. Yeah. I was going to mention that suit. I very consciously wear the same suit every Sunday. I've worn it every Sunday for 7 months, and I will until it falls off my back. And until it becomes too frayed that it's ugly and it's drawing attention to itself. But I very consciously am doing that. But it's no longer a thing with me. I don't think about it. Oh, this Sunday with suits, oh, I'll wear that same old suit. I'm doing it to make a statement because I was attracted very much to John Holkey, who preached at Olivet, because he was the first time I'd ever been to a church where the pastor wore the same suit 3 Sundays in a row. Most, I grew up in churches and have been around pastors who have closets filled with suits. And they buy a new one every season change. And they wear a different colored belt, big fat white one, or a different colored vest and this. And I have just vowed I'm going to just be one color and one suit in that pulpit as long as I can. So that people won't think, well, he's wearing this suit this Sunday to say this and this suit this Sunday to say this. It's just a dark, plain suit. And that's all I want to say, just so people can forget about it, I hope. So, yeah, I think if I were to do that every area of my life, like this guy did at Bethel with that black thing, and I always wondered what in the world was going on. He attracted very much attention to himself. Homosexuality. My guess is that in a room like this, there are people who have homosexual inclinations, at least, if not, are homosexuals. And I have three pieces of statement. I think that homosexual desires are wrong to have, and homosexual relations are wrong to pursue. Now, statement number one, don't deny them if they're there. Own up to them. No sense in trying to sweep them under the rug. You've got to admit that that's where you are and not try to convince yourself you have heterosexual desires. Second, I think you should admit their abnormality. That's not what our society is saying, the gay movement. We have you say that they are equally good to heterosexual desires, but biblically, I can't make a stand. Admit their abnormality, their wrongness. They're in the same category with people who want to have sex with animals, which the Old Testament condemned right along with homosexuality. Most people would admit that that's wrong. It's unnatural, against nature. And then third, pray for help. Both help spiritually for transformation, but also that God would bring you help from outside, and that would lead to the fourth thing. Seek counsel from somebody who's had experience in helping people in this regard. And there are good Christian homosexual counseling centers in the Twin Cities. And if anybody wanted to seek me out privately back at church, I'd be happy to put you in touch with somebody who has more experience than I. I have not had much experience in counseling with homosexuals, but I went to a breakfast meeting, for example, a few weeks ago that the South Area pastors had, and a young fella came who was a homosexual and told about his ministry in Minneapolis on Hennepin Avenue and other places where they try to minister to these guys mainly, although there's a girl on the staff too who ministers with girls, and how they try to love them, help them, discover what their problem is, and then through a series of therapy, change them. And he himself talked about how he had discovered his homosexual tendencies early on, that he was an acknowledged homosexual, shacked up with a guy for a long time, and then was converted to Christianity, and only through a very long period of time, now is planning to actually get married to a girl this spring now. And he's got this piece of paper, I can let you read it, of his life, a brief survey of his life story. And now he's becoming a minister to homosexuals. There's an article in the most recent Christianity Today entitled Homosexuals Can Change. So I don't think that we should view it as an unchangeable life situation, but that through therapy there can be change. And that's all I think I'd want to say now, unless you want to raise questions about that. That sounds like they made a mistake in that. In other words, while I said I think it is wrong to have those inclinations, a person who feels that way, that he's agreeing with God that there are wrong inclinations in his body and that he wants to change, is pretty much in the same category with the rest of us who have sinful inclinations in other regards, greed or selfishness or pride. And we took all the greedy and selfish and proud people out and went to Arizona school classes. We don't have anybody left. Now, so that if he had come to me, I would have had to judge whether or not he was so in the grip of this that he was bound to harm these kids. If he was not,
If he was really struggling against it, then I wouldn't have put him in a special category by himself and try to work with him, so that, well, if it was a her, so that they could gradually change. I think that the church ought not to rule out homosexuals. Practicing homosexuals, that is, who say, I'm not sinning, are people who are in the same category with those who are committing adultery and won't admit it. I mean, won't admit that it's wrong. It's okay for me to do this. Then the church needs to exercise discipline.
Hey, the person that has come to Bethel in the last 4 or 5 years came this year for education and influence society. They've got her, was an ex-gay Christian now. And is in the ministry for helping gay people. And the two things that impressed me most about him was that, one, the sin is, okay, he acknowledged it as a sin, but him himself was not an abomination to God. Him himself. The act may have been, the act was, it was a sin. But many times the Christian came up to him and called him personally an abomination to God. No more, I mean, he's no more than, say, we are. The act was, because it, I guess it specifically says the act is an abomination.
Before he was converted, you mean? People were saying that.
Converted, correct. And basically that the sin is no different than any other sin. But also that homosexual tendencies are not necessarily the root of the problem. They are more often than not a symptom of something else. And not specifically, you just can't say, well, I'm homosexual and that's my problem, and then work on not being homosexual. Many times you have to go in and look at yourself, analyze where you come from, and circumstances in your life that may have led you to believe you were, deal with those, and no purpose for what happened to him, and then work from there. And more often than not, you'll good guys help. You're serious about it.
I'm sure good counselors would take that route. You've got to find the roots. Is there another hint? And we should cut it off here, Tom, so these people can rest. They've been really patient. I mean, rest by
running around or
doing whatever you want to do. I'll start with some questions that have come. Holy Spirit is, and ask for Him to come now in His fullness to us and grant us wisdom and grant us to love You and to have affections that are strong and directed towards Your glory. Lord, I feel so much that if each of these people here loved You 100%, that 90% of the sexual problems would be taken care of within that love. Help us, I pray, therefore, to bank our hope fully on Jesus Christ who died for us. Accept His forgiveness for all the past sins of our lives and to look to Him for guidance for the future and for hope for eternity. And so enjoy His fellowship and His power in our lives. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Two of them almost ask the same thing. One says, if a couple has been physically intimate, is it best for them to get married? Exodus 22 says, if a man lies with a virgin, he should marry her. And another one that's similar says, if a person has had sexual intercourse outside the bonds of marriage and has a choice to marry or not marry, should they for just that reason? In other words, does God view their flesh as married? Let me read that passage from Exodus just so we can see the whole thing. It says in Exodus 22:16, if a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the marriage present for her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equivalent to the marriage present for virgins. So it's not so simple as it must marriage must follow upon sexual intercourse. You've got a father here who says, no way will that man have my daughter and then the Bible makes a provision for what he should do to make restitution, namely pay the appropriate sum of money. So, my answer to the question would be, no, it should not be assumed that if you have had sexual intercourse with somebody outside marriage, that for that reason you should marry them. I think there should be better reasons than that, and I have counseled at least one couple not to marry who have been involved in that way, because the prerequisites for a lifetime of marriage are not there. And I was just talking with Noel, and I think we agreed that one sin, you ought not let one sin be the means to wreck the rest of your life if this marriage is doomed for failure because of incompatibility in many other ways. Better to deal with that sin for itself, let it go behind you, and then move on from there. When Paul counseled the people in Corinth in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians not to go to a prostitute, because in going in line with a prostitute, you become one body with her, I don't think he was inferring that therefore you should marry the prostitute that you lay with. I think he would have said that if he did.
I have a couple of questions. I have a problem. And that has to do about, I honestly can't say what to tell you. I'm writing to you now. I'm excited to ask you a question. I have a couple of friends who go to things, not married, and they're not going to be able to do that. And they have since become Christians. And right now they're struggling very much because they're overwhelmed with this intense guilt where they didn't feel guilty before. And how do you convince them, or how would one go about convincing them that sin is taking care of them?
Well, you can do that as effectively as I can, I'm sure, with the biblical. You use the scripture. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. You lay out the promises to them. He died the just for the unjust to bring to God. Our sins were nailed to the tree. Collect all those wonderful promises of why Christ died and spell it out. The real problem is not making it clear to them, but the psychological stumbling blocks that lie in the way of accepting forgiveness, and that only comes through prayer and the Holy Spirit. So you just pray for them and then try to demonstrate your God's own acceptance through yours. Okay. The two other questions that I have that were handed in, one, would the desire you get when looking at Miss Black Velvet be holy or unholy? That is, sinful or unsinful? My question is that if you turn this desire towards the Holy Christ, is it a sinful desire turned towards Him? That is there a process to turn this desire from a sinful to a holy desire? Or are you saying that this desire, isolated, until acted upon, is not sinful yet? It might be that I catch it one time before it's sinful, and I have to wait, and sometimes it's already sinful. In other words, I don't think there's anything sinful about the sexual desire that begins to rise when stimulus comes. But very quickly, and who knows where that line is, it can pass over into a very fleshly indulgence. So I think I can catch it sometimes, especially now that I'm prone and trained to do it. Usually catch it before I have to feel any guilt for it at all and just turn it right towards Christ. If I'm especially weak that day or especially already prone towards some kind of sexual fantasy, then it might be that it gets away from me and I don't catch it until it's too late and I have to say I'm sorry to God that I went that far with it. So I think the answer to that one is sometimes it's simple and sometimes it's not. And the last one is, how can you learn desire for your fiancé or spouse if you feel that something has altered your desire for sex? say, a bad experience, etc. I take this to be a situation in which it might be either that you once felt desire, but now I've lost it because of some bad experience, or in marriage you never felt it. First thing that Noelle mentioned when she read this was, step number one would be to make sure to talk about this in the marriage, so that if one party were feeling no desire for this act, in fact feeling maybe revulsion towards it, and yet trying to keep that from the spouse, though that would just be terrible, because you'd pick that up in a hurry if you were the other person, you'd know. So step number one is to talk about it and to together, sympathetically, try to find out the root, the reason for this. What was this bad experience? Can we talk it? And maybe there's sin that needs to be repented of. Maybe there's acceptance that needs to be felt by the party that is looking back with dismay. And that might be, that would be a definite stepping stone on the route to healing. Then I don't think I can give any more specific answer, because not knowing what it might have been that's caused the distaste or lack of desire for sex. And it could be that some counseling could poke up out of the background what it was and then heal that or change that. And probably if you've got a loving spouse who hears about this, they can be patient and say, well, is there anything I'm doing that is bringing to remembrance something that is worrying you, or is anything I can do differently that will make this event more pleasant for you? That'd be the best I could do there, without knowing more particularly what sorts of distaste there is or what sorts of reasons there are. I suppose some good counseling might help. Now, the question we want to talk about the rest of the time is, what is sanctified sex after, or better, in marriage? And I had four questions that I only answered one of, but I think we could talk about all of them. The four questions were, how often should you have sexual relations? Are there moral limits to what is allowed? Is the use of pornographic stimulation wrong? And what are the keys to happy and fulfilling sexual relations in marriage? And I'm going to start with the last one, because probably the other three will be answered along the way. And I wrote down 13 things that came to my mind that make for a happy and fulfilling sexual relation in marriage. And these won't take the whole time, so I hope there'll be time for lots of questions, and I want Noelle to be a part of this, and I want you to feel free to ask questions to either of us as a 12-year married couple that might help you in the future. There's no very good order of these, I don't think, so I'll just start with one here. A happy and fulfilling relationship to Jesus Christ for both individuals is, I think, essential. And by a happy and fulfilling relationship to Christ, I mean the joy, the peace, and the righteousness that come from knowing, loving, and trusting Him. Where this first allegiance is askew or absent, everything will be askew. Remember, sex is for believers, especially. So, I just can't overemphasize how my life with Noelle hangs on our life with Christ. We live with Christ first. We pray together with Christ first. What is between us and Jesus is number one, and she is very secondary to Jesus, and I am very secondary to Jesus, and that makes all the difference to have that agreement. I do not know how couples make it where Jesus is not number one. In fact, I know many couples who are not making it, and I'm trying to bail out marriages at Bethlehem, where they are not committed, and they know they're not committed. And they know that's the problem. And they can't change, they say.
One of the things that happens when you know that your husband is committed to Jesus like that is that, or for me, that means that I can trust him completely to be faithful to our marriage. In fact, I trust him so completely that the thought hardly ever enters my mind. It's just such an assumption. And it's with all the other kinds of daily things that come up that you have to work out, and disagreements you have, and problems that you need to work out. To not have that question niggling at the back of your mind makes such a steady place to build your marriage. I don't think that could be true if that commitment to Jesus weren't there.
It just affects every dimension of your marriage. Absolutely every dimension. It affects the way you discipline your kids, the way you earn your money, the way you write your checkbook, what you eat, where you go out, what you do with your leisure time, the way you keep house. It affects everything. If you don't have that common foundation, then you're always groping for some other foundation and not finding it and running into problems. Stop me any time that you want to ask a question about it. I'll just keep going if you don't stop me. Second, in order to have a fulfilling sexual relationship, you must show respect to each other all the time. You'll notice I'm focusing on the wide circumference of marriage, not just on that hour spent in sexual relation, because, as you'll see in a minute, most of what goes into making that hour good, it happens not during that hour. Respect shown to each other. I tell you, in these 12 years of marriage, the number of hours that we have spent with other couples watching them put each other down is just disgusting. Christian couples who spend most of their conversation needling each other. And some have just got into a habit and don't even know they're doing it. They can do it with their eyes. They can put their partner down with their eyes. Snide little nitpicking. So seldom is to run into a couple in their own home or out together when they say kind things about each other, upbuilding things, remarks about each other's strengths instead of stupidities or weaknesses. And you want to kill a sex relationship? Just talk about all the stupid things your wife does, or all the stupid things your husband does, or what a nincompoop he was the other night, or just wreck it. And that's going to wreck the whole marriage, but the sex will be one of the first things where you'll sense the inadequacy anymore. So respect. This is something we've really had to work at. I've had to work at a lot. Because it's so easy when people are different. And all of you are different and will marry people different from you. When you're different, to perceive those differences as inferiorities or superiorities, and therefore tend to put her down, belittle her or him. The old nag works both ways. She's always on his back to pick up this or pick up that. Now that'd be one problem if that's a state at home. But usually what happens is she gets into such a habit that he's bad here, he's lazy there, he's inadequate here, that when they go out, you know what Joe did the other night? Here's this guy here getting the thumb like this, or he to her. And that's...
And stupid things make such good jokes.
Yeah, it's very often done under the guise of humor. Number three. In order to have a happy and fulfilling sexual relation, you must show tenderness outside the bedroom. You must show tenderness outside the bedroom. The foreplay for good sex at 10 p.m. starts at 7 a.m. and goes on with word and touch all day. And I had to learn that after we got married, well after we got married. Guys, you need to know this especially, that preparation of a woman for a happy and good sexual experience can take hours and can be very verbal. So that If you plan, oh, this Friday night, we're going to have a great time together, if you're married, say, you better work at that all day Friday. Better work at it. Thursday, too. But all day Friday, certain phone call during the day, a certain comment, certain way to kiss when you leave in the morning, a pat on the back of the head or a stroke in the morning when you leave. These little things will work in her mind all day to get her ready. And if you come in there having been a crab all morning and come off like a loafing animal at night and expect her to perform beautifully at 10, that you're just crazy. It isn't going to work. Foreplay is much more than a few minutes of touching in the right places. That's, we men forget that the woman is very different in that regard. Yeah.
Does that take sometimes the element of spontaneity out of it? I mean, can a woman be spontaneous sometimes?
It seems spontaneous, but it's because of having been prepared. Or either because of my own thinking or because of his thoughtfulness.
Well, suppose you, on Monday, you decide to go on Friday night to, say, a concert. And then, it's generally assumed that when you go out to the concert, then you come back, you know, and Friday, maybe your day of the week or something, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not married, I don't know if it works that way. suppose it happens that, okay, you're planning towards Friday, but then, you come home Thursday night, and all of a sudden, you know, Dr. Piper feels like having sex Thursday night. Can it work? Are you spontaneous that you're flexible enough to go on Thursday night without planning all day?
I can answer that.
All he's saying from the man's side is don't just wait till the last minute and expect everything to be really good for both of you. Not that that's the only time that you'll ever have a good experience together. Because I may have been feeling especially tender toward him during the day, because, not because of anything he's done, but because I was putting pictures in our photo album and was remembering some happy times together. Or I read a story that made me think about things I like in our relationship. So it's not just him who prepares me for a good experience, but he's smart to work at it, too.
But, okay.
Not just depend on me to happen on those occasions.
But do you have to be prepared always?
No. But I'm not going to be, I will not be prepared at all if we've been unhappy with each other during the day. Nothing's going to happen at the last minute to turn me around. Or it would take something really, really dramatic to turn me around.
There are several things involved here. We'll be talking more about it, Bo.
Aren't you saying then that it's more you wanna as a guy and will work more tenderness in your lifestyle instead of just, you know, like you said planning, well, and it seems to conjure up the idea while you're kind of scheming and stuff like
that's
that.
A good,
but really,
yeah.
Really you're not.
That's
you're,
a real good
you're
point.
You're trying to work more tenderness into your lifestyle.
I think so.
In your relationship with one.
That's
yeah,
real
that's,
good.
That's one of the things that I have told him occasionally, is that I want more kissing, touching, and arms around me, just completely isolated from leading up to when we're dead together.
That's one of the things I had to learn after I got married. That
I like to cuddle a lot more than he does.
Quite apart from calling it foreplay.
Yeah.
I called it foreplay at 7 a.m. in the morning. She wouldn't call it foreplay because, in fact, if she thought I were aiming at that, it would probably take away some of the pleasure of it. So, yeah, I think your point is really good.
So you're not, in your head, you're not mentally thinking that it's foreplay.
I might be.
Well, yeah.
I might be on a given day. In other words,
yeah.
Because if you're busy, you might have to pick a day of the week. There is only one. 1 hour this week where it can fit if you're a busy person. And you want it to be good and therefore you know what it takes to make it good, and so you may do it. If your schedule is not that flexible, then, I mean, inflexible, then you may, I think we ought to do what Bo says, work tenderness into our relationship so that there could be a lot more spontaneity, and we'd be ready whenever the occasion presented itself. Yeah. Was there another hand? Tenderness outside the bedroom. The point being, readiness for beautiful sex is not made once you get into bed. It's made in a lifestyle. Fourth, don't always do it when you're tired. That's simple. And it needs to be said because we live in a culture, a night culture, where sex is associated usually at nighttime, and people work their heads off, and they're dead tired at night. Maybe they do what you say, they go to a concert, the concert's not over till 11, they go out to have coffee after they get home at 12:30, and then they expect to have great sex, and probably he has to get up to golf in the morning and break a day or something. So I think flexibility as to time is really important, and depending on how busy you are, planning, I think, becomes then essential. If you don't plan that it's going to happen at 9, it probably won't happen till 11, and your bedtime is 11, and boom, you're up an hour later than you should. You're dead tired when you get up in the morning. You're crabby all day the next day, and your relationship has been wrecked for a few days because you did it at the wrong time. So don't always do it when you're tired. Fifth, the man, especially, must be sensitive and gentle and slow, not like a Mack truck. He must know her pace. That was another thing I had to learn after we got married, since we didn't do this before we got married. Namely, that, and this takes years of training. I think it does for an average guy. Years of training to contain himself. It is not easy for a young married man to keep from having an orgasm while he waits for this unbelievably slow girl to get up to the point where she's going to have an orgasm. And I tell all the couples that I'm counseling in premarital sex, don't expect the perfect simultaneous orgasm for a long time. You may be lucky, but this is an art that will take you years to get down, several years. You'll have a good time on the way, don't worry about it. But if you have this ideal of, you know, perfect simultaneity and climax, not for a long time, unless you're very different than Noel and me. And it's basically my problem. And I'm the one who has to take the responsibility to know her pace and pace myself so that I don't lose her. Because the main problem in that is, if you, we'll come to this in a minute, if you want her to have the fullest possible experience, you can't blow it in 2 minutes, because then you've got nothing left. You don't have an erection anymore. You can't bring her to fulfillment. So you got to keep from having an orgasm for 20 minutes, maybe. Not easy. Lot of self-control. Lot of training. And if you're a guy who just is in there for, you know, the immediate thrill, then you won't have that patience, you won't care, and you'll have a very frustrated wife. And she might even know she's frustrated. She may not know that that's not the way it's supposed to be.
You try to, in order to control that, you can sometimes dwell on other things. But does that take the intimacy out of it for her? If you have to think about maybe
camping, the checkbook,
or the checkbook,
add
or
numbers,
whatever.
Count sheet. She doesn't know it.
You don't tell her. Obviously, you don't tell her. But
I don't whisper in her ear what I'm doing.
Okay, but I'm asking you, do you do that?
Oh, yeah.
And that helps.
It helps. Right.
To just keep occupied.
Utterly block. I use numbers a lot. I count at weird orders. I learned this from her, what's that pre-birth thing we go to? CEA, they teach you to breathe. crazy rhythm. See, one, two, three, breathe. One, two, three, four, breathe. One, two, breathe. And the whole point of teaching a woman to breathe like that is she totally blocks out what's happening down here in this pain of contractions. I just adapted that for my own self, and I count one, two, one, two, three. 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I don't have to do that much anymore. I did that more a few years ago. But you see, the man's mind, he can control within 10 seconds whether he has an orgasm by what he pictures with his mind. And therefore, he must exercise great control over what's happening in his head as he's trying to bring his wife along. And if the only way to save this for her is to think about numbers or the checkbook or the kids or something, do it for her sake. I don't like it. See, I don't wish I didn't have to do it because it diminishes the value of it for me. But, man, to satisfy a wife, to have a satisfied wife, is the most valuable thing in the world in this whole affair. Let's see now. Man must be sick. Okay, that was 5. 6. There must be candor and honesty. If the physical openness does not accompany mental and spiritual openness, it will not be a completely satisfying act. Communication and perception of need are absolutely essential. Now, I'm thinking there in general terms, first of all. A marriage will be second rate in which secrets are kept from each other. Remember this nakedness idea? If you love one another, you want to be naked before each other. Naked mentally, naked bodily. But then we'll bring it into the actual event of the sexual relation itself. You should talk about what pleases each other. Ask each other, do you like when I do this? What do you like me to do most? A lot of couples, I think, are hesitant to ask, to talk about what they're doing. Noelle told me on the way up here she likes it a lot when I ask her because she doesn't feel as free to take the initiative to just outright state what is pleasing or not. So the talking in the actual event of sexual intercourse, of course, once you've been married a certain number of years, there's not much else to talk about if you said it, but it's good to now and then again say, is this still the way it was? Or is there anything else happening? Because changes do happen.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It may not be as necessary as often as when you're just beginning to know each other, but I've changed quite a lot. It's my way of responding or the way I like to do things over 12 years. And so if we didn't talk about it now and then.
Right. That's one of the main reasons for communication. Most couples feel they've communicated very intimately in their engagement days, and they fail to realize they are both growing persons, changing a lot, and that communications is the way to keep tabs on that. Very honest, open talk. 7. All grudges and animosities must be worked out well in advance. All grudges and animosities must be worked out well in advance of this sexual event. Now, of course, I think for the Christian, you don't even need to talk about sex. You ought not hold grudges, period. But the sexual event is a kind of a barometer to see how you're doing. And if you have grudges against each other because of the way you're keeping house or the money you spend in a wrong way or something, and yet you try to go on just as if everything were normal into this event, a dimension of the sharing and the dimension of intimacy and dimension of trust will be missing. And when that's missing, then you're on your way to treating her as an object or treating him as an object just to get the physical thrill. And I don't think the event should ever be merely physical. It ought to always be personal. It ought to always be a statement made by the eyes as well as by the other parts of the body of trust and love and appreciation and so on. 8. This is one of the most important ones of all. Each person should make it his or her goal to please the other person most. Each of the two persons should make it his or her purpose in the event to please the other person most. That's why you wait for her. Now, let's see. There's some different implications. Some implications of this we should try to spell out. One would be, for example, there will be many occasions of sexual intercourse in which one, let's say it's the woman, I don't think this is ever true of a man, in which the woman will not have an orgasm. And she will know that at a certain point. I'm not up for it, too tired or whatever. And she ought then to communicate that so that he's free to set his own pace. And that will be very, very helpful to him. So she will please him by saying, I'm out of it, basically, as far as orgasm goes. I'm here for you now. And he will do his thing. He'll set his own pace. Another implication of this would be to raise the question, how often should you have sexual relations? Now, if each is trying to please the other person most, you run into a contradiction here. Because, since I think this is more average, let's say the woman in the relationship doesn't need it nor want it nearly as often as the man. Now, that's not always the case, guys. I have counseled couples in which the problem is exactly the reverse. She wants it a lot more than he'll give it. So, but I'm just going to use as an illustration a situation in which the woman doesn't want it as much, because I think that's more common. Now, if he's making it his goal to please her most, then he probably won't ever ask for it when she doesn't want it, right? Every 3 or 4 weeks. If she's making it her goal to please him most, then she'll be ready and eager to do it whenever he wants it. So you got a contradiction. How often are you going to do it? How are you going to figure that out? And I think the answer is going to be, I was asking Noel, now what can we say last night as we were talking about this? The conclusion I came up with was this, and I base it on 1 Corinthians 7, basically. The person who needs the sex less should give in most. The person who needs the sex less should be the one who gives in the most. In other words, in the instance that I'm saying, where the woman doesn't need it every 3 or 4 weeks and the guy might like it twice a week, she will be the one who bends the most and maybe does settle on once a week. He won't demand it necessarily every time, but if he has a wife who's trying to please him as much as she possibly can, he'll have it more than if he were just doing it whenever she wanted. They'll strike a kind of balance. Maybe some months she'll give a little more, and some months he'll give a little more, and there'll be a lot of loving dynamics that go into this. This is why allegiance to Jesus is so important, because if you got the heart of Jesus, you're willing to be uncomfortable for the other person. That's the essence of love, to give to that other person when you don't necessarily bodily feel like it. And I think that's a problem in lots of marriages where there is a big discrepancy between felt need. In answer to the question, how often is good or right or appropriate, Martin Luther said he was satisfied with twice a week. He said that in one of his table talk discussions. I don't know how many children he had. Jonathan Edwards had 11 children. There's an interesting story about Jonathan Edwards. I think 8 of his children were born on Sunday. And they had the old wives' tale in those days that you were born on the day when you were conceived. And his people were very irate that he was. What's the pastor doing on a Sunday afternoon? Every...
some of the congregational churches did not baptize the babies more on Sunday because it
proved. I didn't know that. That's devastating. There is no rule of thumb about rightness or wrongness in matters of frequency, I don't think. That's wholly up to the inclination of the couple involved. And I think it will vary. It's going to vary with lots of different things. It'll vary with stress greatly. Whether the husband and wife are under great stress because of work they're doing or sickness at home or financial problems. The more stress you're under, the less you'll feel like sex. It'll vary with leisure. You'll do it lots more on vacation than when the heavy burden of work is on. It's the same principle probably as I mentioned earlier. When you've got lots of leisure, your mind will roam around to those sorts of things more quickly. What else will it vary with? Anybody think of any? Weariness, though. Weariness that if you're dead tired, you don't. There have been rare times when Noel would have liked it and I said no because I was absolutely out of it. Gone. So weariness and other things. So there are no rules about frequency. I think I asked Noel, well, are there any statistics we could give them so that they'd know if they were in the ballpark? And I think once or twice a week is real, real normal for lots of people.
But is it married? Newlyweds, I heard, have tended to do it more.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Don't you think that the responsiveness of your partner is going to depend on, like, if you don't feel like it and he does, isn't that going to sort of take it out of you?
Yeah. It'll depend on with what attitude, how she handles that. If you've got a good wife who loves you, she can make it great for you when she doesn't want to do it. But if you have a wife who's a self-pitying little snob, she'll probably let you know and make it quite miserable for you whenever she doesn't want to. That's why Jesus is all important, I think. But no, it need not take all the joy out of it. In fact, there have been times when Noelle, quite for me, has given herself to me, and the love manifest in that event has made me like her so much that it was extra good. You see what I mean? She was doing it so totally for me, and doing it with such grace that I just loved her all the more. Now, she could be resentful and let me see that, and go, oh, here comes me now. As soon as she did that, I said, well, forget it, though. Wait till you're at it. So it's the way, it's her attitude and the way she handles herself.
Is there any general way of finding out, how do you know when you're too busy? Like say if stress is the roadblock, how do you know when that stress is just part of denying yourself for Christ's sake and for the work of the gospel? And how do you know when you're really damaging your marriage?
Well, Noelle's my barometer for whether I'm damaging the marriage or not. She tells me, you're damaging the marriage.
And we see it in other areas. I don't sense it in relationships and our sex life, but in all the other areas that are falling apart.
Yeah, we're... I don't know. Our sex life is not the first thing to go. We really have a good time there, and even when other dimension areas are getting weaker, that is one of the last things to go. That's not true with every couple, but just what would be the first barometer that probably just touchiness and irritability.
And no time to talk about anything. Yeah. That are making you touchy.
Yeah, we haven't been together. We haven't spent 15 minutes together in the last 3 weeks. What's the problem? I'm seeing you. Where have you been all this time? And then you start getting crabby and making statements about each other, and they start getting louder at the kids, and it just starts to show itself real quickly. You can tell when the marriage is going well, and people feel happy and fulfilled. Things are clicking, right? And when that isn't happening, then you need to stand back and say, now, what has gotten out of control here? And for us, generally, it's my time has gotten out of control. I haven't spent enough time at home or with Noelle. And then we have to back off and work at that.
So you're saying it's God's will for that to go on for a certain period of time, and then He indicates to you that you better now stop, or do you realize that you've gotten too busy to begin with and you need to rethink of that?
I didn't see the difference between those two. They both sounded...
It takes a little time, but when there's too much going on, it takes a little time for it to back up enough to show itself.
Yeah. If a marriage is a good marriage, it's got a buffer. It's got a resiliency that will take a good bit of battering, schedule battering. But no marriage is so strong that schedule battering can go on forever. Not spending time together can last. There's that period of time in there in which the deterioration is undetectable. And then all of a sudden it comes out in certain things and you realize that you've set up some bad patterns for a few weeks.
The marriage should always get a priority. Something in the schedule has to go.
Yes, something in the schedule has to go. That's right. I think the marriage... A minister ought to minister to his family as much as to everybody else. If he forsakes the needs of his own family, he's not.
Thank you for listening to this message by John Piper, pastor for preaching at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit Desiring God online at www.desiringgod.org. There you'll find hundreds of sermons, articles, radio broadcasts, and much more, all available to you at no charge. Our online store carries all of Pastor John's books, audio, and video resources. You can also stay up to date on what's new at Desiring God. Again, our website is www.desiringgod.org. Or call us toll-free at 1-888-346-4700. Our mailing address is Desiring God, 2601 East Franklin Avenue, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55406. Desiring God exists to help you make God your treasure, because God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him.